Tell the people what you're here for.
Bring everything out closer to the people.
Basics, community newsletter, community newsletter.
We got to stop it, brother. Let's get together and unify.
Trouble, trouble, trouble.
An oppressed person will fight back.
Radio Basics.
And there's always a message involved.
CHRY 105.5 FM. Today, Thanksgiving, October 11th here in Canada, Columbus Day in the United States. Thanks everybody for listening in. This is Kabir. I'm doing it solo today in the studio. Shout out to Steve and Dave and all the other hosts of Radio Basics who weren't able to make it on today. Today is Thanksgiving in Canada. As we well know, Thanksgiving in the United States has a much more perverse and colonial meaning, in the sense that it celebrates the genocide of indigenous people on this continent, beginning with the arrival of the so-called pilgrims and their use of chemical weapons, including smallpox and other diseases, to wipe out indigenous people on this continent. And, of course, Columbus Day, with that same legacy, celebrating who was arguably the greatest mass murderer in human history, Christopher Columbus, responsible for the decimation of millions of native people in the Caribbean and Latin America. And while Thanksgiving in Canada doesn't have the same colonial meaning, in the sense that it doesn't celebrate a specific event in Canada's criminal history, this is not to say, of course, that this country was not built due to the genocide of indigenous people. This country would not exist, Canada would not exist, if it wasn't for the policy of Holocaust that the Canadian state has implemented and subjugated native people to, whether that be in the past or even in the present day. However, Thanksgiving in Canada does have its own problematic issues, in the sense that this holiday is really used by the state, by the corporate media, in mainstream society, to kind of give people the message that they should be thankful for what they have, they should be happy with what they have, and to deny and in fact prevent people from looking to and seeking out issues and grievances they have in terms of the way they're treated, in terms of the oppression and repression, exploitation that they face here in Canada, as well as the to understand and to recognize the crimes of imperialism throughout the world. And so it serves kind of as a day for people to kind of just be thankful for what they have, to not ask or demand for more, and serves in fact to inhibit struggle and resistance. And so that's something that we should, you know, as people with social consciousness, as revolutionaries, detach ourselves from, and recognize this as a day to be thankful. Yes, thankful for, you know, the struggles and the gains that struggles of people have had in the past and have won in the past. To be thankful for all the great people's movements, all the great revolutionaries that have blessed us throughout history, as well as in the present day. On an individual level, to be thankful for family and friends, for health and well-being, but also to recognize that there are a lot of things to be unthankful for, to recognize the crimes that have taken place throughout history, including, you know, right here in Canada, and to recognize the struggles, you know, that need to take place today to truly achieve justice and dignity for all the peoples throughout the world. And so that's the message, you know, Radio Basics wants to send out on this October 11th, Thanksgiving Day in Canada. Turning now to international and local news, on Thursday, September 30th, police in Ecuador staged a strike in six cities across the country and trapped President Rafael Correa in a Quito hospital in an attempted coup d'etat. Thousands of people assembled in the streets in defense of Correa, and the coup attempt was condemned by various civil sectors, including indigenous organizations who have struggled against his policies. After 12 hours in a police hospital, Correa was freed and returned to the presidential palace. This marking, the third time in just the past few years in which there has been this attempted reactionary coup d'etat against a populist government in Latin America. This began in 2004 when the government of Haiti, led by President Jean-Bertrand Aristide, a popular government, a government that was elected, you know, by more than 91% of the population, was overthrown by Canada, the U.S., and France, in fact, by American Marines. It continued with Honduras when, again, the coup government continues to be in place. The reactionary coup government continues to be in place in that country. And now we have this attempted coup d'etat in Ecuador, again, against a populist leader that has challenged some of the policies that the United States has put in place in his country. Now, for the most part, this was thankfully a failed coup d'etat. The interests of imperialism were not obtained. The people were able to win back, and with the help of the army and of course the popular movements, Rafael Correa is currently in power. And in fact, three police commanders have been charged with this recent unsuccessful coup attempt. It's interesting when we look at this to kind of understand who are the actors that perpetrated this coup d'etat. To look at the fact that one of the three police commanders that were charged in this recent attempt against President Rafael Correa has been identified as a graduate of the School of the Americas in Fort Benning, Georgia. School of the Americas, obviously the infamous school of terrorists that was run and continues to operate through the Central Intelligence Agency in the United States. It has trained, it has put out some of the most violent, some of the most hated terrorists and reactionaries throughout Latin America and, in fact, the world. People who have been responsible for massacres, for coup d'etats, for illegal acts throughout recent history in Latin America dating back to the 1980s. And according to SOA Watch, School of America Watch, was an organization set up to monitor the characters that this school of assassins puts out. Colonel Manuel Rivadeniera, excuse me for that pronunciation, was a graduate of the School of the Americas Combat Arms Training Course. And Rivadeniera was the commander of the barracks where President Correa was attacked by protesting police. And so, despite the fact that in Honduras and in Ecuador, the United States and its allies, including Canada and Western European powers, did not show their face, meaning that it wasn't white hands that grabbed the president from power. They did so indirectly through their proxy forces in those countries, and we need to be very clear in recognizing who is responsible for these violations of international law and whose interests are served by coup d'etats and overthrows of popular officials who are rejecting neoliberal economic programs. In Europe, hundreds of thousands of people protested European Union-wide austerity measures. Actions took place in Portugal, Ireland, Slovenia, Lithuania, Greece, Spain, Britain, and Belgium. In addition, at least 1 million people took to the streets and paralyzed the French capital over a proposal to raise the retirement age from 60 to 62. Austerity measures being put in place throughout Europe, obviously to the detriment of the working class population there, and people are resisting that. Also, a report by a UN fact-finding mission about the Israeli raids on the flotilla of boats bound for Gaza last May, boats that were bringing humanitarian supplies to the besieged population of Gaza, which has been prevented from having even basic necessities by the Israeli apartheid government. This investigation concluded that five Turkish citizens and the one U.S. citizen who were killed by Israeli soldiers last May were in fact shot execution style, some while lying wounded on the deck of the Mavi Marmara. And this corroborates what video evidence, what people were saying for since that horrific massacre took place, is that Israel wantonly murdered these six international civilians who were simply attempting to defy in a peaceful and humanitarian way the horrific policies that Israel has subjected the besieged population of Gaza to. But don't expect any international condemnation of Israeli actions coming from the Canadian government. In local news, First Nations in Ontario denounced Premier McGuinty as the Liberal government passed the Far Northern Act, which will create large protected areas in Northern Ontario, but will also allow the government to override First Nations land use plans. As we have stated time and time again, this is a quote from an Indigenous leader, "We do not and will not recognize the legislation on our homelands." And this was a quote by Deputy Grand Chief Mike Metatawabin of the Anishinaabe Aski Nation in a press release. The NAN represents 49 Indigenous organizations or Indigenous communities covering two-thirds of the province's land mass. And here in Toronto on Wednesday, September 29th, 26-year-old Eric Asawe was shot to death by police in his brother's apartment at Kipling and Bloor. Eric grew up in the Lane neighborhood of Jane and Finch, he was killed during a supposed police raid on the unit on his brother's apartment. This was police claimed that they had found weapons and other ammunition in the apartment. But many people suspect that this is yet another murder of a young black man by a notoriously violent police force. The family is quoted as being, quote, distraught, broken, and hopeless. A spokesperson for the family told the CBC in response to ridiculous accusations and quite racist media extrapolations that somehow this man was guilty before even being judged, quote-unquote, by the SIU due to the fact that he had a previous police record. So there were these statements being made in the media in response to this. A spokesperson for the family, a good friend of the victim, said, quote, "Just because I've been in trouble in the past does that mean in the next time the police come to my house, I should expect a bullet? It's not right." And this shooting, this killing, comes just a month after Toronto police officers killed a black youth, 25-year-old Jardin Douglas, from Pickering. He was suffering from schizophrenia and was shot multiple times by cops on the night of October 30th after running from a streetcar at Victoria Park. Tragically, it was in fact the family that had called the police to find Jardin Douglas, as he had run away from the family as they were trying to transport him to a hospital, and they had warned police of his mental illness. Police did not heed this warning and proceeded to shoot him multiple times, many witnesses claiming that police shot him while he was already on the ground. Police officers claiming, and there's no witnesses to back up their excuse, but that they're claiming that Jardin Douglas had a knife on him, which still wouldn't explain the need for multiple shots. A man armed with a knife facing numerous armored men with weapons, with ammunition. And so really, you know, we can see that the police violence in Toronto has in fact only increased. That makes three, all of them young Africans, murdered by police this year. Of course, we remember Junior Manon, who was beaten to death by nearly seven police officers on the campus of York University last May. And this is absolutely despicable. The SIU, which is investigating the case of Eric Asawe, as well as the case of Jardine Douglas, has no credibility in the eyes of the people of Toronto and the racialized youth who are victimized by police on a daily basis, as they have never turned up a conviction in all the years they've been in operation. And we recognize that it's going to take a mobilization of people in the city, mobilization of racialized youth and other youth that are affected by police brutality, for this phenomenon, this social violence, to end. We're going to go to commercials, and we're going to come back with a track, and we're also going to play a documentary, a radio interview that our Radio Basics host Steve DeSilva did at an event commemorating the anniversary of the foundation of the FMLN in El Salvador. And this this event took place at Steelworkers Hall this past Wednesday. We're going to play that interview. Stay tuned. Radio Basics, CHRY.
Estás escuchando CHRY 105.5, tu estación de radio comunitaria. Escucha en vivo en nuestro sitio web www.chry.fm.
My mother always told me, those who live in glass houses shall not throw stones. Real talk. Our education getting robbed by the government. You get to check, you getting robbed by the government. Our native people got robbed by the government. Who really the thief they portray as you and me? Yeah. The working class getting robbed by the government. Poor people evicted for condos and luxury. The truth by media get robbed cause of government. Who really the thief? They show you once. They call me a thief, charging me with robbery and breach of the peace. But can we take a look upon these beasts? They the ones that come and shoot us down in the streets. It's that days back to the clowns from the east. I'm talking about Europeans, English and French, came to this land, found man, made friends and enslaved them, took advantage of trust and enraged them. Old Canada, the land stolen from the natives and First Nations, people driven to starvation. They kidnapped their children, put them in the basements, forced assimilation. It's like slave breaking. Now enough of them is sniffing glue or staying wasted. Just another race erased, more recent. They thinking that this minimum wage is decent, taking 15% off the checks we receive. And we can't go to school cause we banned for no reason. Education getting robbed by the government. You get to check, you getting robbed by the government. Our native people got robbed by the government. Who really the thieves they portray as you and me? Yeah. The working class getting robbed by the government. Poor people evicted for condos and luxury. The truth by media get robbed cause of government. Who really the thieves they show you on TV? The same schools assholes make schools traps that'll leave you with a case before class. Trouble waiting on the ad for you to get out of the bin. Cause with a criminal record you can't get employment. So they stay employed. No takers in the courthouse to go and inform the snort makers in the courthouse to go and inform the principal and the staff too. Till you and your boys ain't allowed in the classroom. Now that's robbery. So how could the queen represent my country and charge me with larceny? Further with the fuckery, it's hard to be humble when I see what they do in the region and jungle. TCHC trying to come up on the double. History repeats itself. It's no puzzle. It's exactly what happened to Africville when they move all the blacks to the helm and they can't be for real. Education getting robbed by the government. What? You get your check, you getting robbed by the government. Our native people got robbed by the government. Who really the thieves they portray as you and me? Yeah. The working class getting robbed by the government. Poor people evicted from condos and luxury. The truth by media get robbed cause of government. Who really the thieves they show you on TV?
Some Quan Che off his new mixtape, The Prelim, that was Robbed. You know, incredible track. He made that when he was much younger. In fact, just probably my age, 17 or maybe even a little bit younger than that. That's obviously a really well-known Canadian rapper from the Vaughan and Oakwood area, and has been affiliated with a number of Basics campaigns. In fact, he performed at the Justice for Owie basketball tournament that took place at the beginning of September. We're going to go to an interview by Steve DeSilva that was conducted this past Wednesday at an event at Steelworkers Hall, 25 Cecil Street, commemorating the anniversary of the foundation, the initiation of El Salvador's revolutionary movement, the FMLN. Radio Basics, stay tuned.
This is Steve DeSilva reporting for Radio Basics for CHRY 105.5 FM. I'm here at Steelworkers Hall on October 9th, 2010. We're here with the Salvadorian and Latin American community celebrating the 30-year anniversary of the foundation of the FMLN, the Faro Bundo Martí National Liberation Front in El Salvador. And I'm here with René Guerra Salazar, an FMLN member here in Toronto, with us tonight. Thanks, René, for being with us, man.
Thanks, Steve.
So, 30 years now. Take us back to El Salvador, 1980. How is it that this organization came together? And describe for us a little bit about the decades of struggle that the FMLN went through.
Well, Steve, 30 years ago, five political military organizations came together and formed the FMLN, a front to combat a repressive government, a military dictatorship, that had changed presidents every now and then, but was basically the same thing, backed by an oligarchy that controlled the economy. And decades before, in 1932 to be specific, there was an uprising by peasants and by indigenous peoples, and that uprising was in that uprising, the Communist Party of El Salvador was involved, and unfortunately that uprising was quelled very brutally by the Salvadoran government at the time, and there was a massacre of up to 30,000 people in 2 weeks' time. It was actually the largest massacre in the Americas in the 20th century. Very few people know that, but it did happen. And in fact, there were Canadian battleships just off the coast of El Salvador protecting Canadian interests. At the time.
Canadian ruling class interests.
Absolutely, Canadian ruling class interests. And the reason why I mention that is that after that massacre, the organized left in the country was, you know, shocked. It was traumatized by this experience. And there was very little sort of public organization, public mobilization against successive right-wing governments. But slowly, surely, as the years went on, there was a greater call, or there was a call for greater action on the part of the working class, and different organizations emerged, all of them coming from the Communist Party of El Salvador. And during the 70s, there was a lot of heightened activity. There was a lot of different organization from these different organizations, different mobilization on the streets. And eventually, you know, all five organizations realized that in order to face, in order to effectively face the government of the time, they needed to come together. Right? They needed to find unity. They needed to coordinate their activities. And so on October 10th, a historic moment, October 10th, 1980, they decided to form the FMLN.
So here we are 30 years later, and the FMLN in the past couple of years has ascended to political power in terms of the presidency, in terms of the, is it the National Assembly?
It's the presidency.
The presidency, leading political party in the country, but yet when we look at El Salvador today, we see that there's so much that needs to be done still in terms of the revolution. I see a couple weeks back, basically the gangs, the criminal organizations in the country, basically seems like they declared war on the government. So describe for us a little bit about the current situation in El Salvador and the task that still must be done by the revolution.
Well, I mean, we need to sort of take things into perspective. I mean, there was a 12-year civil war, right? 1980 comes about, the FMLN launches its first general offensive. There's a 12-year civil war. And the only reason why the war lasted so long was because the Salvadoran government was financed by the United States. It was billions of dollars that were spent. And I mean, the FMLN would have defeated the Salvadoran government, would have taken over state power. But because of that financing, it wasn't possible. The fact that the FMLN was able to resist for so long and force the Salvadoran government to negotiate peace, right, that happened in 1992, there were peace accords signed, is commendable. Now, you have that process. The FMLN becomes a political party. It begins to struggle more now in the political arena.
You mean a legal political party?
Legal political party, right? It starts off in 1994 with a presidential election, and then successively there were elections at the municipal level, at the legislative level, and slowly but surely the party had been growing up to, we have last year, March 15, 2009, an historic moment. The FMLN candidate Mauricio Funes wins the election, becomes president of El Salvador, the first president from a leftist party, an historic moment. But that's only part of the picture, right? I mean, in El Salvador, you also have a legislature, right? In order to pass laws, you need majority in that legislature. Although the FMLN has the most seats of any party, it doesn't have an outright majority, right? There are three or four other parties, and they're all right-wing parties, and so they all gang up on the FMLN, and it makes it very difficult. Now, when you have at least 20 years, right? I mean, because the former party, Arena Party, was in government for 20 years. When you have at least 20 years, if you don't count all the decades, perhaps centuries, of domination by reactionary right-wing forces in the country, when you have that, and you have a new government that's promising change, it takes time. It takes time. I mean, we're talking about things that are entrenched in Salvadoran culture, in Salvadoran practice. I mean, we're dependent on the United States for remittances. I mean, it's from our own people, right? The same people who end up leaving the country because they can't find Salvador, right? We're dependent on their remittances. It's a very difficult situation, and you know, I mean, we're starting off. It's 1 year of Mauricio Funes' government, right? In January, there are municipal and legislative elections, and these are very, very important. We need the FMLN to win a majority of seats in the legislature so that, you know, laws can move forward. The agenda can move forward at a faster pace than it is right now.
Yeah.
Now, the politics we're seeing at the level of the legislator reflects a political and social base, the social base of the FMLN. And for people maybe unfamiliar with the history of the struggle in El Salvador, the history of the FMLN, from the outside, this may just seem to them like a political party jockeying for power with a military wing, right? And people have this impression that, you know, well, what is the social basis of the FMLN? What kind of social changes and struggles at the grassroots level were the basis for this movement being able to change a little bit at the top?
The FMLN, all five political military organizations, come from the grassroots. They come from the base. They come from peasants. They come from workers. They come from people, everyday folks who were fed up with being massacred, being murdered, being tortured, being excluded. They came together and they said, no more.
Yeah.
And it came to a point where they needed to take up arms. Right? And they needed to take up arms in self-defense. And they were being massacred. So, I mean, we're talking about, these are the sectors of Salvadoran society that came together to make up the FMLN. So it's sort of the opposite of what you described. It's a popular movement that ends up having a political wing.
Reflection, yeah, that's right.
To struggle in the political arena as well.
When we look around the world today, we see a lot of movements, revolutionary movements, in a similar situation. That is, they've been able to take their mobilization to a certain extent within the boundaries of their country, yet they've not been able to completely rid themselves of the ruling class formations that exist in their country. You know, we look at Bolivia, we look at Venezuela, we look at Nepal. In all these cases, the revolutionary movements brought the people very far, but they've been basically at this juncture where those most parasitic classes that are supported by U.S. imperialism, by India or any other regional powers, they haven't been able to proceed beyond those obstacles. You know, what is the next step for the revolution? Well, how is the FMLN looking to take the revolution to the next step and really bring power to the people?
Well, I'll say this, in every situation, in every case, is different. I mean, it depends on the particular circumstances of the country, the community, the history. And I tell you what, in El Salvador, I don't think it's too much to suggest that, you know, the way things are going now is the only way they could have gone, right? Given the circumstances, right? We're talking about a country where, for decades, it has been ruled by right-wing governments. I mean, generally speaking, the Salvadoran people, I would say generally speaking, socially, are conservative. They're conservative because they've had to live this way, right? I mean, this is something that has been ingrained upon the people for decades, right? So in order to get that to change, and there was significant change that happened in raising consciousness and raising awareness during the 1980s, during the Civil War, in order to get that change to the point of electing a leftist president, I mean, you have to understand, for a lot of people that are sitting there in the voting booth, to put an X, to put a check mark beside an FMLN flag, right? An FMLN flag. When they've been being fed by the media on a daily basis, the FMLN is, you know, they're going to take away your children, they're going to send them to Cuba, which might not be a bad thing, to be honest, but, you know, they're going to send them to Cuba, they're going to take away your house if you have one. All these ridiculous things. When they sit there and mark an X, that is incredible.
That was a huge,
you know, it is a huge leap forward, and things are relative, right? And, you know, what is the next step? Well, the next step is you move on to the next possible struggle, given your circumstances. In El Salvador, you know, it might be different from other places. It certainly is different from other places, except certainly from Venezuela and Bolivia and Nepal, which are the examples you mentioned. But we need to do it at our own pace. We need to do it within our circumstances, but never losing sight of the end goal. And this is key, and this is where the FMLN has never lost its...
And what is the end goal?
The end goal is to create a just society, to create socialism in El Salvador, and that has never been lost. And it's still there. It's in our statutes. It's in our part of our discourse. It's part of our history. We in our memory, we maintain that history and memory. We're not going to lose it.
So here we are in Toronto, celebrating the 30th anniversary of the FMLN. We're in a country where the criminalization of liberation groups, people struggling for justice and freedom, is becoming more and more harsh and intense under the banner of the war on terror. The Canadian government is attacking and criminalizing a lot of individuals and organizations, and the FMLN being one of them, most recently or at least moving in that direction with the attempt to criminalize a refugee who has been here in Canada for 13 years, Jose Figueroa. What do we make of the Canadian government's move to try to deport Figueroa on the basis of allegedly being a terrorist, from what they're saying? What do you have to say about this?
It's ridiculous. I mean, listen, I'm an FMLN party member. There are thousands of us in this country who have current or past ties to the FMLN. For the Canadian authorities to suggest that those ties to the FMLN make us inadmissible in Canada, or unwanted in Canada, in our own country, because I'm also a Canadian citizen, is absurd. And then for them to further suggest that it's because the FMLN committed acts of terrorism during the Civil War is absolutely ridiculous.
Mind you, know, this is a country where any politician would who knows what they would pay to shake hands with somebody like Nelson Mandela, who only 25 years ago was considered a terrorist, and he was in jail for being a terrorist, right?
Absolutely. And we're talking about political discretion being wielded here. We're talking about, listen, in the last 4 to 5 years, this categorization or this characterization of the FMLN has intensified. We know of several cases, in addition to Jose's, where this has happened. We know of Salvadorans who have been deported. We know of Salvadorans who are under threat of being deported. We know of high-ranking FMLN members that are currently part of the Salvadoran government, including somebody who's a part of the equivalent of Elections Canada in Salvador, who've been detained for the same reason. It's absolutely ridiculous. And we can't help but speculate that it has something to do with this new conservative government's approach to Latin America. You know, they group the FMLN with governments that they don't see as favorable, such as the government of Venezuela, the government of Bolivia. These are governments that are actually trying to enact changes that are in the favor of everyday people in Latin America. And of course, this isn't in the interest of the clients that the Conservative Party serves. So we're absolutely outraged as Salvadorans that this is happening, and many Salvadorans across the country are organizing to make sure that the Canadian authorities know of that outrage.
What's the current status of Jose Figueroa?
Well, Jose right now is, you know, he's still struggling. He has a good support, a good group of people supporting him in Vancouver. He's still under threat of deportation. He filed an application for a judicial review with the federal court. Unfortunately, the federal court rejected his application and won't even hear his case, which is shameful. But he's also now asking for a ministerial exemption from Security Minister Vic Taves. And it's actually that ministry that argued that he was inadmissible because he was tied to the FMLN and because the FMLN was a terrorist organization. So it's a difficult application, but he has a lot of people that are backing him, including, ironically, his own Langley-based MP, a conservative.
Yeah, Mark Morrow. I actually heard a radio program on the CBC the other day was talking about this, and the conservative member of parliament was actually backing his case.
Exactly. So, I mean, that goes to tell you how absurd the situation is, how ludicrous, how Kafkaesque it is, and this is why, you know, I mean, for me as a Salvadoran, it's important for us to make our voices heard. You know, we can't wait for other people others to take up a cause that affects us directly. We need to do it, and this is why here at the event tonight, we've been promoting the case to other Salvadorans in Spanish.
Yes.
To make sure that they're more aware of the situation, to make sure that they stand up for their rights. We can't be, I mean, this terrorist tagging, it's got to stop. It's happening to racialized communities throughout the country, and we have to put a stop to it. I mean, it's absolutely ridiculous.
Yeah, sure. Well, when we look at the list of designated terrorist organizations in Canada, we see organizations on there that have massive bases of support in their own countries. I mean, once upon a time, the Communist Party of Peru, the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, the Kurdish Workers Party, the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine.
Listen, one, as the saying goes, one person's terrorist, another person's freedom fighter. You know, and these things are historical. They depend on the political context at the time. And I tell you what, during the 1980s, the FMLN was not considered a terrorist organization, despite all efforts by the state.
I understand that even there were some unions in Canada that were supporting the struggle.
Absolutely. Despite every effort by the State Department to, you know, paint the FMLN terrorist, the international community said no. I mean, the 1981 Franco-Mexican Declaration clearly stated the FMLN was a belligerent, you know, governed under the laws of international laws of war. I mean, this... You can't do that. You can't. The reason why it's being done, and I'm telling you, is ideological. It's ideological discrimination, and we're not going to stand for it.
So, Brother Rene, any final words for your working class people, progressive people here in Canada and Toronto, other communities in struggle tied back to, you know, struggles in their own home countries? Would you have anything more to say?
Well, I mean, the struggle continues. It's been the same in our party, in our movement. The struggle continues, and la lucha continúa, and the FMLN continues to be in solidarity with all people who are struggling around the world against injustice, and we can continue to do that till the end.
Right on, brother. All power to the people. Radio Basics reporting, signing off. October 9th, Steel Workers Hall. Thanks, Renee.
Thank you. See you.
I'll do this for thrills. We do this to defend. And I sent y'all to this to kill. Y'all living in illusion while we live out here is real. Blood spills, so cold you get chills. We do this for necessity, y'all do this for thrills. We do this to defend ourselves, y'all do this to kill. Y'all living in illusion while we live out here is real.
Yeah, man, so it's the other side. That's my opinion, you know what I'm saying? You got any more questions? Most high, cold blue, in the smoke shop. Smokey. Throw one entertainment.
The voice of the community. This is CHRY 105.5 FM.
You're listening to Radio Basics, CHRY 105.5 FM. That we were playing before the commercial break. We were playing an interview conducted by Steve De Silva, who's a host here at Radio Basics, an interview he did this Wednesday, October 6th, at Steelworkers Hall with or around the anniversary of the founding of the FMLN, which is the Revolutionary Movement, People's Movement in El Salvador. And the person he was interviewing discussing not only, you know, the details surrounding the emergence of that people's movement, but also kind of decrying the hypocrisy and reactionary nature of labels such as terrorist and other such labels directed at people's movements that we often hear, the most recent of which listeners will ring bells in listeners' heads will be the labeling of the LTTE, the Tamil Tigers, as a terrorist organization by Canadian officials, despite the fact that, you know, it does have huge support among the Tamil population and is in actuality fighting against a government which has been talked about time and time again by human rights groups, by UN reports, as engaging in human rights abuses and violations, flagrant violations of international law. So, in fact, fighting against a terrorist government. And we can see these same hypocrisies, around labeling Hamas and other groups resisting Israeli apartheid as terrorist organizations. We're going to play, what's even more hypocritical about this whole labeling and governments like Canada and the United States being the ones who decide who's a terrorist and who's a legitimate structure or organization or political party is the fact that Canada and the United States are two states that were in fact founded through terrorism. Whether we talk about the terror inflicted on Indigenous people beginning in 1492 when Mr. Christopher Columbus arrived, did not discover, but accidentally stumbled upon to, of course, the unfortunately, because that what followed was the decimation of the original peoples of that land, but stumbled upon, the West Indies. So beginning in 1492, that wave of terror leading up to the terrorism inflicted on African people, on the stolen people that were brought as slaves to the United States and to Canada, and continuing till today when we continue to see terrorism inflicted by the Canadian and American governments in their actions overseas, as well as, internally when we talk about violence and political oppression directed at Indigenous people here in Canada, against poor and racialized people here in Canada and the United States, when we're talking about police brutality as a form of terrorism. So really, Thanksgiving, most definitely, the Canadian Thanksgiving is problematic as well and has definitely been used by the state and the corporate media as part of this whole framework. But undeniably, so the American Thanksgiving, celebrated November 25th, and today being the Columbus Day in the United States, are simply celebrations of terrorism and terrorists. And so I'm going to play a short clip. It's an excerpt from the award-winning documentary, The Canary Effect. And it's just going to give you a little rundown for those that don't know about what Columbus Day, this today being Columbus Day in the United States, is all about.
Everybody thinks that 1492 is some magic date in which Columbus discovered, quote, America. But Columbus was in the Caribbean, and he never at any time came to the United States.
No, he never was near the continental mass of America. The great navigator that he was, you know, who washed up on a beach in the Caribbean, half a world away from where he thought he was, gets known as the great navigator. The navigator could never find his way from the island to the mainland. He couldn't discover the continent.
Oh, I think it is rather surprising that they should have reddish-brown skins. But now since we have landed in India, then these people must be Indians.
It's very interesting that Columbus's first comments regarding the Native American or the indigenous people was that they were very loving, giving. They would trade or give anything that they had. They were without malice, without guile. The whole concept that Columbus thought these were savage people was totally incorrect.
Call this part of India San Salvador, and I take possession of it in the name of the King and Queen of Spain.
It's hard to discover an occupied territory. I often go for the first time to visit people who have moved into the area. It may be the first time I've been to their living room, but I can hardly say I discovered it. I mean, after all, they lived there. Much less can I extrapolate by virtue of my noble achievement of knocking on their door that somehow or another the newly discovered living room becomes mine.
The general consensus is that Spain came for God, glory, and gold, and God being that they were going to spread the Catholic religion, glory because they were going to add more land to the crown, and of course gold because they were going to get rich.
Columbus had no trouble getting ships and men for his second voyage, but he still hadn't the slightest idea that he was headed for the vast continent of America.
They issued documents to the native people to be read to the native people, saying, "If you don't convert to Catholicism and give us the gold, we will do all types of harm to you. We will kill your families. We will take your land. We will enslave you." And when native people didn't tell them where the gold was, or in many cases didn't know where the gold was, the Spanish simply tortured these people. They burned them at the stake alive. They had large hunting dogs that they fed the Indians to. It was death and destruction.
Bartolomé de las Casas, who was there during Columbus's tenure as governor of the island, placed the beginning population at about 3 million. 20th century historical demographic studies had placed it as high as 8.5 million. Whatever the reality actually was, it had been reduced to about 100,000 by the time he left, and by 1550, it was gone. Extinct. Columbus is symbolic, but what Columbus symbolizes is hideous. Columbus being valorized in the mythology of the United States is roughly the same as Germany valorizing Heinrich Himmler now. And in teaching this to Jewish students, as well as German students, and conditioning them to accept it.
But each year on October 12th, we celebrate Columbus Day. The anniversary of that day in 1492, when Columbus first sighted the land of the New World, America.
And that just a short clip from the award-winning Canary Effect. And that featured, most notably, hopefully listeners will have recognized the voice of Professor Ward Churchill, who's an incredible indigenous scholar, writer, professor, and who has just been recently, and is a professor at Colorado University, most recently was in the news after the United States government, after many fascist pundits, including Bill O'Reilly and other individuals on Fox News, on CNN, and all these other racist and xenophobic media outlets attacked him for his some comments that he made. In fact, a quite articulate essay around 9/11 specifically, but also about the acts of imperialism the United States has perpetrated on the rest of the world, and comparing that to the event of 9/11 and explaining the history of imperialism of the United States. He was attacked for these comments. His heritage, his identity as an indigenous person was attacked, but thankfully, in fact, he just recently won a lawsuit against the university for an unfair termination and won that that court battle. And so in that discussion, hopefully this is not new, this laying out of the history of Columbus Day, the history of Christopher Columbus's crimes in North America. We understand that Thanksgiving, the celebration of Thanksgiving on November 25th, has a similar heritage. I actually just wanted to point out that one of Christopher Columbus's greatest crimes actually set the stage for and was the initiation into imperialism for a country that has really been in the news recently, which is Haiti. When he landed in Haiti in 1492, exterminated the Taino indigenous people, Taino Indians in Haiti, exterminated that entire population, proceeded to set the stage for other imperial powers to enter into the island, eventually France. First it was called Hispaniola, and the Spanish Empire began importing slaves from Africa, and then of course France, the French Empire, took over and began stealing millions of black bodies from the continent of Africa and bringing them over, shipping them over to Haiti to be interred as slaves. And of course we know black people, the black population in Haiti rose up in 1792 in the first successful slave rebellion in history, very much inspired and taking from the lessons and the philosophy that had been shared with them by the very few remnants and survivors of Christopher Columbus's Holocaust, the indigenous people of Haiti, who had instilled in them these virtues of resistance and struggle. And so through that revolution, the first successful black revolution in history, and because of it, really, the people of Haiti have never been allowed to forget that great crime, which was their liberation. And that legacy continues today, where we see people in Haiti, 8 months after the earthquake, still living in destitution and despair. And so we understand the legacy today as the United States does celebrate Columbus Day, and indigenous activists, including Ward Churchill and Russell Means and many other people associated with the American Indian Movement and other organizations in the United States, have really mounted an incredible campaign of information and to dismiss and dismantle these myths about Christopher Columbus and about the so-called discovery of America, and expose them for what they really are, which is the American Holocaust, the Holocaust of millions of Native people that began in 1492. That extends to Thanksgiving, in fact, which is simply the celebration of the supposed pilgrims who, in fact, and I'm getting this information, I'm looking right now at the book by Ward Churchill, A Little Matter of Genocide, which you can pick up at most bookstores. I would suggest getting it from a different book list. Where he talks about the supposed pilgrims as, in fact, colonists who were trying to settle in the area that eventually became New England in the 1600s, in the early 1600s. Their attempts to settle in this area had been resisted, had been routed by indigenous groupings, indigenous tribes in this area for many years. And eventually they resorted to the typical behavior of European colonists at this time, which was to kidnap the indigenous residents of the original inhabitants of this area, to shoot them, to murder them, to sell them into slavery. He talks about in 1608, people from the Plymouth Company coming in, shooting indigenous people, kidnapping them, and eventually turning to chemical and biological warfare, and by that I mean smallpox. I mean diseases that were deliberately infected and inflicted on indigenous people so that the population of 13,000 Pequots, which was a grouping of indigenous people in the area in Plymouth and Massachusetts Bay, was reduced from 13,000 to 3,000 in the matter of basically 10 years, 15 years. And so that's the kind of genocide, that's the Holocaust, that's the American Holocaust that we're talking about, and that is in fact celebrated and being celebrated in the United States on Thanksgiving on November 25th, and today being Columbus Day. Really perverse holidays, which we really should suggest, reject when we're talking about developing a social conscience and a revolutionary culture in opposition to the mainstream white supremacist culture, which is fostered in the United States as well as in Canada. And while I do want to say happy Thanksgiving to everybody out there, to yourself and your family, to be thankful, not only be thankful, yes, for everything that we have, for family and friends, for the struggles and the gains of people's movements throughout history, but also to remember that there's a lot of things to be unthankful for. There's a lot of struggles that continue to need to be waged. There's issues of injustice both here in Canada and throughout the world that need to be struggled against. And so we really should look towards how we can make this world a better and more just place rather than simply accepting what we have, because truth be told, it's not enough, and we don't live in the best society we could. So thank you. This is Radio Basics signing out. This is Kabir on this Monday, October 11th. Stay tuned next week. We'll be back in the studio with more revolutionary programming. I'm going to go out with a feel-good song. It's not exactly the most conscious song, but I do want to play it. Ice Cube, today was a good day. Radio Basics. Break them. The Lakers beat the Supersonics. I felt on the big fat.
deep, so deep, so deep, put her ass to sleep. Woke her up around one,